is United States against Brown. And we will hear from Mr. Berman.
May it please the court, I'm Morris Berman, and I represent Frank Brown. I represented him in the district court. Let me first shorten the issues that are at issue here. For various reasons, including strategic reasons, we are not continuing to pursue the Ashcroft issues, and that those are no longer part of this appeal. There are issues that are very much in play in this appeal, however. Mr. Brown entered a conditional plea to possession of child pornography. This was material that was found during a no-knock search warrant at his house in Beloit.
Could I just ask you to clarify what you mean by the Ashcroft issues? Are you in agreement with the statements in the government's filing after the Ashcroft decision that this case was one that included charges both about virtual images and images of actual children?
Yes.
Okay.
In any event, this was a no-knock search warrant which the magistrate judge later determined that he should not have issued. He should not have given that authority for no-knock entry. Then at the time of sentencing, Mr. Brown, via me, either in writing or at the time of sentencing before Judge Crabb, we indicated that there was no evidence that Mr. Brown received or distributed any of the material for commercial purposes, that he had no monetary gain, and that he did not trade on a numerically equal basis with anyone else.
Doesn't this raise pretty clearly the we have this Black case, which you're relying on, and then the argument, the counter-argument seems to me to be primarily based on the subsequent change of the guidelines, which they regard as interpretive and rather than substantive. Isn't the real issue what kind of weight we ought to give to the subsequent developments in the guidelines?
Well, you can look at it two ways. One, we contend that this case falls squarely within the facts of Black, and that Judge Crabb was bound by...
Well, that may be true, but if something has happened since Black which would justify a different interpretation, then maybe we ought to follow that.
Well, two responses. One is that would be giving an ex post facto effect to this subsequent guideline, which is not to be done. The second one, which I had addressed in my submission to the district court, was that the subsequent amendment provides for various gradations of enhancement. And if any enhancement, this would be one which would be subject to arguably, not conceding that, but arguably a two-level enhancement for some sort of distribution, one that's not for monetary gain, one that's not for other pecuniary gain. In other words, the two-level enhancement under sub E rather than the five-level enhancement under the other provision.
But, you know, it's odd to think that that barter isn't covered unless there's some sort of balance that we decide, numerical equality or something. Barter happens all the time in commercial transactions, in transactions like this. I think the district court was observing, you know, that people will swap comic books around, or college kids will swap their DVDs around or whatever, and they all gain. And if you nail it down too specifically to money, you're really missing a great deal of economic activity.
Well, that may be, except that, you know, Judge Crabb and the district court also thought that, well, the facts were somehow different in Black, and that the court was bound by the stipulation. Facts were not substantially different in Black. As I reviewed the facts in Black, the defendant there, and Your Honor was on the panel in Black and probably knows the facts better than I, that there were five uploads by Mr. Black, six downloads and two distributions to other subscribers to AOL. So there was really no difference in the fact in the Black case and Mr. Brown's situation here. I think there was no consideration, there was no quid pro quo. That type of bartering maybe falls within some sort of exchange. Although I submit that under the stipulations in Black and the fact that we're not contradicted by the prosecution in this case, there was no gain. This court said, in based on those stipulations in Black, that it was clear that those exchanges or the transmission by Black were not for any kind of gain.
What's gain? I mean, suppose you have three college students and they say each one of us will buy five CDs, and somebody has a CD burner on their computer, and so they've leveraged their purchase of five CDs into 15, each one of them has, by an agreement that they'll just burn, because the blanks don't cost anything worth worrying about. Not so hypothetical. I mean, as a parent of college students, I can assure you this happens all the time. Isn't that pecuniary gain? I mean, you're it's like getting them on sale or something. You get more for your money.
Well, but I don't think that's necessarily what happened here. There's no evidence that that sort of thing happened here. There was discussion that somehow the transmissions, even if there was no anticipation of something in return, which is unlike the master college student situation, burning CD situation that Your Honor described, there was not necessarily any sort of anticipation that something else would be obtained in return, and so I think that's distinguishable. There was some sort of musings, both by the district court and by Mr. Jones, who represented the government in the district court, that somehow maybe there would be some sort of intangible here, some sort of facilitative effect, but there we're really pushing the envelope as to what is pecuniary gain, well beyond what I think was contemplated in Black.
So here, I just want to make clear, your client has admitted to trading in pornographic material.
Well, he admitted
to
trade.
And sort of inherent in trade is I trade one thing and I get something back.
Well, his statement was not as specific as that, and I'm not sure whether his statement is in the record. It was an exhibit at a suppression hearing. But it wasn't as crystal clear as whether he traded.
But he did admit that he traded.
There was the word trade was used.
Right, and what I'm saying is, it's not that he was saying, you know, I put this material out there, but he said he traded. I'm just saying inherent in trade is when you trade, you expect to get something back. There's an expectation.
If you're to read that much into it, the statement was also, I traded them to people who had an interest. It didn't necessarily imply that, or didn't necessarily say he was getting a quid pro quo. And
he didn't say I sent them to people who had an interest. He said I traded them.
He said I traded them. What he meant by that was never really elaborated. There was also a search warrant issue in this case, and I just want to raise very quickly, because I know my time is short here, the question here, I submit, Your Honor, is whether we actually have any sort of exclusionary remedy when there is an improper entry. This is something that if Kip Jones is read expansively, as the government, I believe, is advancing here, there is no exclusionary remedy for misconduct in the way of search warrants executed. Other cases by this court, the Espinoza case, which is not in the brief, which I'll submit under 28J, I think your dissent speaks to the fact that there must be some remedy. Otherwise, the police can blow off the door with a howitzer and justify and find the evidence admissible under inevitable discovery. That runs straight into Richard and Wilson, and that just can't conform with the Fourth Amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berman. Ms. Green?
Good morning. Alice Green for the government in this appeal. Well, obviously, I'm changing directions on the argument given the concession we received this morning on the free speech issue. So if there are no questions on that, I will proceed to address first the matter of the trades. There is evidence in the record, not only handwritten statement of Mr. Brown that was made at the time of his arrest, but also at his sentencing hearing when directly asked by Judge Crabb, did he trade, he acknowledged that he had.
So you think inherent in the idea of trade is pecuniary gain?
Well, under the circumstances of this case, and under the old guideline, we believe and we argue below that it met the broad concept of pecuniary gain as defined in Black, which included swaps or trades, and the evidence here shows...
Doesn't pecuniary either connote or denote money?
The way we read Black, and I don't think it has to involve the concept of money per se. It meant gain in the sense that he got something of value in return for something that he traded.
I mean, this case is pretty close to Black, isn't it? I mean, you've tried to distinguish it, but I don't know how successful that...
I don't think we can ignore the fact that Black had certain stipulations, and this case did not. The government did not stipulate...
Well, that's true, but I mean, the stipulation isn't far from what happened here, is it?
Well, again, I think it's different in that sense. The evidence is clear that there were trades that did give value to Mr. Brown, as the district court elaborated in her analogies to trading.
Well, let's assume that Black is the law of this circuit. Where do you go from there?
I think Black would allow this court to affirm this case under Judge Crabb's reasoning, and also, of course, she offered an alternative reasoning. She said she, given the new guideline that takes care of any question regarding pecuniary gain, she would have applied.
How do we use the new guideline without having problems with the ex post facto?
I think that under the her analogy and her cite to the Coe case, she used the new guideline properly to justify an upward departure because she took into account a factor that the old guideline may not have fully considered. And I
so
think
you're reading her statement as actually saying in the alternative, I am departing upward 5 levels?
Well, she... I believe the way she worded it was... I would reach the same conclusion apart from Black. Given the new guideline and the co-decision, I would grant a departure of 5 levels and come to the same result.
Now, there's some law out there in terms of interpreting changes in the guidelines as between substantive and interpretive, whether it just changes the law of one circuit or it changes the law of all the circuits. Are you acquainted with those? That case law?
I believe generally I'm familiar with what you're talking about. There are some...
Here, I guess it's changing the law of one circuit primarily, but...
I think the Seventh Circuit was perhaps the only circuit to have taken the pecuniary gain concept to that level. But even other circuits that looked at Black noted that it allowed for this broad reading of pecuniary gain to include swaps or trades or bartering. So I believe that under either rationale, Judge Crabb's decision on the enhancement...
Oh, this guy, I mean, there's all that dictum in Judge Cummings' opinion, there's no doubt about that, but but the holding of the case is directly contrary to that, it seems to me, so I don't know how we handle that problem.
Well, apart from the concurring opinion, I believe that the majority opinion also at the very end said we don't mean to limit this. We think it pecuniary gain does need to be read broadly to include gains. I think that, to include trades, and I think that came from the majority opinion. So, as again, under either rationale, we believe that enhancement should be upheld. Addressing the exclusionary remedy, we would simply point to the magistrate's well-reasoned opinion that good faith should apply.
Well, good faith is one thing. Inevitable discovery, it won't surprise you to know, I worry considerably about, since it's hard to see a logical ending point for that rationale. It means that you can forget everything in the procedures that lead up to a legitimate entry into premises, and as long as, if you had gone back and done it right to begin with, you would have found the stuff, all of a sudden it comes in. Doesn't that pretty much read the Fourth Amendment out of the world?
Well, under the current law in this circuit, it doesn't. That's certainly under Jones and the Folk decision, which involved the use of flash bang devices. Certainly nothing like that was used here. Inevitable discovery, which was the alternative holding of the district court here to allow the evidence to come in.
Is it important at all here on the good faith holding that there was no finding that Agent Hansen had any deceptive purpose, or you know, in other words, if the information given to the magistrate judge had been tainted, could a good faith holding have saved the warrant?
I do think this case has the unusual fact that Agent Hansen herself had participated in at least one earlier search where fear of encryption had been used as a basis. So I think that did factor into the decision that good faith should apply.
Now, why would that ever, would it make a difference to you if the fear of encryption meant, you know, A, we're going to have to hire a computer expert and it will take that person a month to decipher the hard drive, or B, we'll have to hire a computer expert and we'll take the person a year to retrieve the information, or C, it's just not possible to crack it? In other words, are we talking about something that just makes it more expensive for the government to retrieve the information, or are we talking about real destruction of the information?
Well, I think we probably are broad enough to talk about several things. Certainly destruction of the information is what was expressed here as a concern.
But of course encryption isn't quite destruction. Sometimes you can crack the code.
True. I'm assuming that is true. I'm not a techie, so not totally knowledgeable about that, but certainly there are devices that can be used quickly. You raised some policy concerns that we all should probably think about. But
what worries me is the government coming in and saying we'd like a no-knock search warrant because it'll make our life much easier for us and we can get the evidence and it'll be cheaper somehow. And it seems to me that's not a good reason for a no-knock search warrant. You need to show something more dramatic, as I understand the Supreme Court's decisions, like destruction of evidence.
Right. And as technology advances, perhaps the sands will shift as well on something like that. But I think given the time of the execution of this warrant, the information that the magistrate had, the encryption, he actually detailed a case where encryption did occur, at least under those facts, I believe that the denial of suppression motion was correct and should be affirmed. Okay. Any other questions? We'll rest on our brief.
Thank you very much. We'll give you a minute if you'd like a brief rebuttal.
I don't believe good faith saves this warrant. The Richards case was decided some 3 years before its execution, and Agent Hansen had been a special agent for the United States Customs Department for some time. Objectively, she would have known. And the magistrate, I don't know whether those other encryption warrants, or at least the one that the magistrate footnoted in his report and recommendation, even involved a challenge to the way in which that warrant was executed. But the magistrate certainly knew of the Wilson and Richard cases and certainly knew that there had to be some particularized showing of the imminent destruction of evidence or some need to dispense with the constitutionally mandated knock-and-announce requirement. The question then becomes the remedy. I think I've spoken to that. There has to be some remedy for a violation of the way in which a warrant is executed, or not only is the Fourth Amendment rendered superfluous, but also those decisions, Wilson and Richard, say that the way in which it's executed, the way in which the warrant is executed, part of the Fourth Amendment reasonableness requirement, are overruled. But of course, they can't do it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And we you were appointed as well, were you not? We appreciate very much your efforts. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under advisement. The last case is submitted on the brief, so the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.